support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Mike Rosenberg from Columbia Credit Union. Mike says they trust what they see and hear on OPB, and that aligns with Columbia Credit Union's brand.
This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. We end today with a conversation about the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, also known as the Triple Nickels. They formed during World War II as the first all-black paratrooper battalion in the U.S. military. They were stationed in Pendleton as part of Operation Firefly, a top-secret effort to intercept and disarm Japanese balloon bombs that were floated across the Pacific. They fought dozens of fires in the Northwest as some of the nation's earliest smoke jumpers, all while facing racial discrimination as both service members and as civilians. The Triple Nickels are going to be honored at an event at the Pendleton Airport this Saturday. Jordan Bednarz is the event coordinator. He is the recruiting and retention director for All Airborne Battalion, a nonprofit that supports veterans. Robert Bartlett is a retired educator from Eastern Washington. He has spent the last decade researching the Triple Nickels. He is a life member of the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion Association. Welcome to Think Out Loud to both of you.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Robert Bartlett, how did you first hear about the Triple Nickels?
I first heard about them through our local newspaper here in Spokane, Washington. It was actually during Black History Month, and they featured a story on the 555th with a full spread picture of the unit in front of an aircraft, and that's how I heard about it, totally by surprise, given the fact that my family is prior military and combat veterans, and I know a bit about military history. So it was quite a surprise, but that's how I found out about it.
What went through your mind when you first heard just some of the details about this battalion?
It was a bit of a culture shock because, as I mentioned, I'm prior Army. My war was Vietnam. My brother's war was Vietnam. My father and his brother were combat medics in World War II, served in all black units. And my family goes back to the Civil War with a great-great-grandfather who fought in the Civil War. And so I grew up around black men who were, except for that one, military veterans. And they never, although they never told war stories, they never mentioned this one. And so it was quite a shock, quite a surprise.
Jordan Bednarz, what about you? When did you first hear about the Triple Nickels?
Well, I had the opportunity to attend paratrooper school relatively early in my military career. And, along the way, you start to learn the nomenclature, the flags, the heraldry of these units. And we, keep books of some of these units going forward. And so even the ones that are no longer currently in service, you can still see the unit insignia, the crests and whatnot. And you can't help but look at that iconic image of the Black Panther against such a brilliant background. And you look at it, I don't care what page you're looking at, what other units, patches are on there. That's the one that catches your eye. And, there's a leadership award, later when I became a non-commissioned officer called the Walter E. Morris, Leadership Award, certainly one that I would never win. It's not in the top 0.0001 percentile. But, the thing that we strive for is to be the type of leader that Walter E. Morris was. And it's no surprise that his origins came from the Triple Nickels.
Robert Bartlett, how and why was the 555th formed?
The 555th was formed actually under pressure. Roosevelt, being president, was being pressured by his Negro Advisory Committee to get more black men involved in combat units serving overseas. He was getting a lot of political pressure to open up combat units to black troops. So that was one of the major ones. The second was there were no black airborne troops in the Army at that point in 1944. So Roosevelt paid a visit to Fort Benning, which was the airborne school, still is, and is quoted as asking, "Where are your black paratroopers?" And they said, "We don't have any." There was a black service company that served across the street, and they were all black troops, that were serving white troops, doing laundry, patching holes in the street, guarding the gate, hauling ammunition, and they were strictly a service company. And once Roosevelt pressured the commander at Fort Benning to do something about this, because he was being pressured, they approached the senior non-commissioned officer at the time in the black unit, which was Walter Morris, that Jordan just spoke of, and said, okay, we want to try this out. There had never been, so we want you to be the first, and we're going to call you a test platoon. And so Sergeant Walter Morris was allowed to take 19 other volunteers to become a test platoon and see if they could cut it as airborne troops. So that's
because the racist question or assumption is, can these black men do what these white men have been doing? Was that a question within the U.S. military?
Absolutely. As historians of World War II, especially black ones, often point to, is the fact that when the bombs rained down on Pearl Harbor, not only was the nation partially racially divided, but so was the military. And as I mentioned, my father and uncle served in an all-black army. So there was a lot of pressure to make this happen. And racism was rampant in the military as well as in society.
Bob, your mom fell off the bed.
I want to hear more about what happened when they were formed and ended up in Pendleton. But I'm curious about, given that background, what kind of thought went into figuring out who the first members of the battalion were and what was the training like?
The selection was left to Walter Morris to go into the black troops and handpick 19 others to do this. Now, back to your question, there was betting among the white troops, that the black troops couldn't cut it. Actual bets were made that these men would not jump out of aircraft, would not be able to cut the training to become airborne troops. So they knew, these men, the 20, that what they were about to embark on was going to reflect on the ability of black troops ever to become airborne or ever serve in combat units. And so they felt the weight of all black people in the country at that point to perform and to succeed.
To zoom forward a little bit, my understanding is that they proved that they were absolutely up to the task of being paratroopers, but they never were sent to Europe or to the Pacific theater. Why not?
Well, they not only passed and were awarded their silver wings at Benning, they were then told, the black troops at that time, Walter Morris and the others, plus 16 black officers that were also commissioned through airborne school and received their silver wings, to build this test platoon that started as a test platoon into a combat unit, that it was on them. So the soldiers then, the 555th men that were in this early stage, went down to Arizona to the 92nd, which was and stayed for many years, an all-black unit of combat veterans, one of the rare ones in the country at that time, Army, and they recruited men down there, and they pushed them through a very rigorous set of criteria just to be able to volunteer, because airborne, they're the only volunteer unit in the military, right? You have to volunteer, and then you have to pass. And so they went down and recruited their numbers, and then they were sent to Camp McCall, North Carolina. And that was going to be where they would do all of their advanced training, build their numbers into combat strength. There were a couple things happening at once. One, there was still a lot of racist among the military leadership at that time. And I ran across a quote once that said, was one of the white officers in charge of the theater in Europe, that we don't want to add more black troops to this effort because we don't want to deal with racism and fight a war at the same time. I'm sorry, I'm being called away, a medical emergency. Jordan, would you take over for a minute, please?
Yeah, absolutely, Doc.
Robert Bartlett, take care of what you need to take care of. Let me just remind folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking right now about the Pendleton-based Triple Nickels. They were the first all-black paratrooper battalion in the U.S. military. There's going to be an event this Saturday at the Pendleton Airport to honor them. We've been talking with Robert Bartlett, a retired educator from Eastern Washington, who has become a Triple Nickels historian over the last decade. And Jordan Bednarz is with us as well. He is from the nonprofit All Airborne Battalion and the coordinator for this weekend's event. So, Jordan, let's zoom forward once again to Pendleton. How is it that the Triple Nickels were sent to Pendleton?
Well, as the doc pointed out a second ago, and in answer to your question, how come these guys weren't sent to Europe, or how come they weren't sent to the Pacific Theater? Because, you know, the average American, if you ask them, what is your concept of a paratrooper? They're immediately going to think Band of Brothers. They're going to think the invasion of Normandy. They're going to think the invasion of Italy and the invasion of the Netherlands, Operation Market Garden. They always think Europe. But what they don't realize is that there was a number of airborne operations that were conducted in the Pacific as well. And some of those operations were extremely low level jumps and very dangerous jumps. So the Triple Nickels in the least, as a matter of fact, it ends up being the feather in their cap going forwards. But the task that they're given is to ramp up what we call rough aerial terrain jumping, and which means jumping into mountains, jumping into trees, which are the exact entities that you usually, your training tells you to avoid. And now all of a sudden, we're going to teach a school, and we're going to tell these guys how to actually jump into that with some degree of proficiency. And this was absolutely completely new technology. The first civilian side smoke jump didn't even occur until 1939. In 1940, the United States of America spun up the United States Army Airborne School at Fort Benning. So we're less than 1 year out from where in the entire world a smoke jump ever took place. And only then was the United States spinning up regular infantry paratroopers, let alone specialized, to not only learn a very, very new technology in certain situations. When once they arrived in Pendleton and they have this new task ahead of them, they actually had to procure some of their own equipment, because in the military, we have what's called an MTO, Modified Table of Organization of Equipment, which is everything you need to get the job done. Well, with this extremely new field, no one really had written a book on what do we need to do it.
I'm back, gentlemen, and I apologize. My 100-year-old mother lives with us, and she just had a slight fall. So I'm back.
Are you sure you can stay with us?
Yeah, I'm okay. Okay. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate your coming back, but need to step away anytime. So how much did these men know about their mission when they were sent to Eastern Oregon?
Would you like me to answer that, Jordan?
You know, I think the doc is probably the best authority on this. Yes.
Robert Bartlett, go ahead.
I'm sorry. They were at Camp McCall preparing to go overseas. And I'm sorry, I missed what Jordan had to add here. But
he was explaining about the newness of smoke jumpers and the differences in the equipment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So smoke jumping actually started in the United States in 1939. And there was a smoke jumper program underway when the Triple Nickel came into being. However, during the war years, many of the men that were in the smoke jumper program went into the military. And so Roosevelt brokered a deal with the peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, and so forth, that were pacifist, to open up an opportunity for them to serve their country by serving as smoke jumpers. And so this is important because the smoke jumper program was going on. It was run by conscientious objectors in a program called the CPS, Civilian Public Service. And so when the men were at Camp McCall training to go overseas, they had no idea that there even was a smoke jumper program. But as I started to say before, the military was not really anxious to include these men in combat at that point. And so there were some major defeats that the U.S. Army was facing, a lot of casualties, thousands of casualties, most of them airborne. These men were ready to go. They thought for sure they would get their ticket punched and be sent overseas. But the war then came to a drastic. It was starting to turn. The Russians invaded and things started turning the other way. So at the time that this was all happening, the military was keeping it quiet that we were being bombed, literally bombed by the Japanese using these balloon bombs, Fugos. And so they kept that quiet. Well, here they had at Camp McCall 300-plus black airborne troops and no overseas mission for them. So the men received classified orders in the spring of 1945 to report to Pendleton, classified orders. They had no idea that there was a bomb threat going on by the Japanese, nor did they know for sure where they were going. They were just told to load a troop train and your destination is Pendleton. And some of the men talked about, well, hey, maybe we're going to Japan, right? Fight with MacArthur. We're heading in the right direction. So they were surprised once they arrived in Pendleton to learn that, no, their duty station was going to be Pendleton and that they were going to be cross-trained by the smoke jumpers, by a few smoke jumpers to do firefighting, wildland firefighting duty, which Jordan alluded to. They were not equipped to do this job. They were equipped to be airborne infantry. So It was a total new thing for them to learn the mission and then to figure out how they were going to do the mission, given that they were being supplied normal military gear to fight as infantry. And firefighting, wildland firefighting, smoke jumpers require a whole different, not only set of skills, but equipment, all the way down to the uniform and the letdown ropes and so on and so forth. So they were given a crash course in how to be wildland firefighters. Then they were told about these balloon bombs, and then they were taught by the Army to disarm the bombs or dispose of them once they came across them. So that's how they ended up in Pendleton, unaware of what was going to happen. They were rapidly cross-trained, given the opportunity to create their own gear, their own uniforms, their own jump gear and everything. So they just made do with what they could get their hands on to do this different job of smoke jumping.
What have you heard about what their lives were like, either, within the military structure in Pendleton or, say, on off-duty days when they were just maybe in the city itself?
When I give presentations on the Triple Nickel, which I have been doing since about 2015, I always title them the same for a reason. I title them Jumping into Fire, because these men literally jumped into the fires of racism. Not only racism in the military, they were treated horribly, but also in civilian life, among civilians, wherever they traveled. You know, my father told the story real quick of getting on a bus in uniform in the States with his buddies and having to go to the back of the bus because that was the colored section. But as they were going to the back of the bus, there were empty seats in the front and a few white men in the front of the bus. Well, when they sat down in the back of the bus, they looked forward and noticed that some of the men in the front of the bus were German prisoners of war. And some of these Triple Nickel also told similar stories, that prisoners of war were treated with much more respect and had more rights than even the men of the Triple Nickel. So in Pendleton, they talked about, and this was again 1945, no shame on them, but 1945, there were places they could not eat. There were hotels they could not stay in. There were bars that they could not frequent. There's a story I captured of a USO event in town. There was a USO club. And they were invited to come because there were very few white military folks there at the time. And so they were invited to use the USO club. They were there early. White troops came in the front door and immediately turned around and went out the back door. They didn't want to associate with them. So wherever they went, unfortunately, because it was the time that it was, they had to fight the fires of racism as well as wildland firefighters. And unfortunately, as you alluded to, I have many stories of things that happened to them in that regard.
Jordan Bednarz, we just have about a minute left, but what can folks expect in terms of the event this Saturday at the Pendleton Airport?
Well, we were going to come in and just do a mere legacy jump, you know, as tribute to the Triple Nickels, but an opportunity presented itself by having Dr. Bartlett come online. We have him in the Pendleton school system. The U.S. Forest Service came online, the Oregon, with a number of smoke jumpers coming down, plus their modern aircraft. And then the Oregon National Guard came down with a Chinook and a firefighting bucket and the personnel to explain it. So we now not only have the fusion of telling the story of the Triple Nickels and their origins, but also the evolution of into modern smoke jumping. And it's so many people have put great efforts into this. Dr. Bartlett, I can't thank you enough for literally being the compass that's given us the task to follow here. It's a family-friendly event, and we hope that folks come out with their entire family units. We're going to have food trucks up there. It's going to be a great affair.
Jordan Bednarz and Robert Bartlett, thanks very much.
You're welcome. No, thank you.
Jordan Bednarz and Robert Bartlett joined us. Jordan Bednarz is the event coordinator for the event this Saturday at the Pendleton Airport to celebrate the Triple Nickels. They were the Pendleton-based very first all-black paratrooper battalion in the U.S. military. Robert Bartlett is a retired educator. He has spent a decade now as a historian and champion of this battalion. Tomorrow on the show, Camp Namanu, a summer camp on the banks of the Sandy River, is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. It was recently added to the National Register of Historic Places. If you attended Camp Namanu, we would love to hear about your favorite memories from your time there. You can leave us a voicemail right now at 503-293-1983. That's 503-293-1983. Thanks very much for tuning in to Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC today. I'm Dave Miller. We'll be back tomorrow.
Think Out Loud is supported by Steve and Jan Oliva, the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust, and Michael, Kristen, Andrew, and Anna Kern.
Think Out Loud and OPB's critical reporting from all across the Northwest happen only with the support of our members. Do your part now and join in as a sustainer at opb.org/pod.